as a kid and you're not even 18 and people are telling you what is not going to happen, what won't happen for you, and basically you're another statistic and you're another number of statistic within the system. You're no longer a person.
Welcome to Black Educators Matter. This is more than a moment. It's a movement.
Hey, it's Danielle. Welcome to Black Educators Matter. Our goal is to share the stories of 500 Black educators. We will celebrate the impact and achievements, learn from the lessons and challenges, and highlight the important roles that educators play in all of our lives. I'm excited to welcome today's guest to our show. As a do now, please tell us your name, your role in education, and answer the question, why do Black educators matter?
Well, hello, Danielle, and thank you for inviting me. My name is Dr. Felicia Rutledge, and I am currently a project facilitator for multi-tiered systems of support, which means I educate school teams and consult them on how to create equitable systems academically and behaviorally. Black educators matter. We matter because when students have at least one of us, they are more likely to graduate. They're more likely to enroll in college. And with two Black educators, they are more like 32% more likely to enroll in college. We matter because we provide perspective, we provide context, we provide a model for excellence within education of what they can be.
Speak it, Dr. Rutledge. So where are you from?
I am originally from Buffalo, New York, but I am currently residing in Las Vegas, Nevada for the last 10 years.
Shout out to Vegas. I love Vegas. So you got some East Coast to West Coast. Do you remember your K through 8 experience growing up in New York?
Yes, I do. My K through 8 experience was in a public school setting, and I had a PE teacher. He was a Black male. He was absolutely amazing. He was so embedded in not just our PE, but in the classroom. And then there were other counselors and social workers and mentors that were also Black on our campus, ensuring that we were doing the right thing, going the right way, making sure that they were constantly in the community with us. So I had a chance to actually see many of the educators out next door, and they knew my family members. And so if I got in trouble in school, my grandmother and my mother knew before I even got home, because it was so embedded into the community that you needed to be visible and you needed to be a part of the community. And so my K through 8 experience was amazing when it came to that. I had a math teacher who was Black. I had my sixth grade teacher. She was absolutely amazing. She was the one who tapped in and just kind of said, "You are amazing with language. I think I want to put you in these orator contests." So she tapped into me very early on, and just it just was an amazing experience from K through 8.
What about your high school experience?
Now, high school is a different animal. Different animal because we had a system back in New York State in which you were put in a lottery system. So you had three schools you picked from, and I picked a school that was based literally on a college campus. Well, that school was, I lived on the east side of the city. The school was all the way on the west side of the city. So I had to take two buses and the train just to get to school every morning. And while I had one Black educator there, she was my ELA teacher. She was absolutely amazing too. It was a culture shock. There wasn't many students. There weren't many students who looked like me. There weren't many of those people embedded into the community that would kind of check on you, check in, make sure you were good. And honestly, I have to say sophomore, junior year, I kind of just stopped showing up. By junior year, I completely stopped showing up, and I had to be taken into school multiple times by a tardy officer. My mother getting the phone call saying she's not in school. Eventually, they just unenrolled me, and so I basically was considered a dropout. But I still managed to come back senior year, and I was like, no, I'm graduating. And everyone's like, you won't be able to graduate. I had counselors saying, you won't be going to college. It won't happen for you. It was just, you kept taking all these psychological mental hits. as a kid and you're not even 18 and people are telling you what is not going to happen, what won't happen for you, and basically you're another statistic and you're another number and statistic within the system. You're no longer a person. And it took a lot of people from my community tapping into me like, you're too smart to just say you're done and you're not going to do this and you don't want to be there. And so I went back, and because we had those regents booklets, so you had a regent booklet that gave you kind of what the curriculum and what the test would look like. And I had to, they also told me I needed, if I was going to actually graduate, I needed to go to night school. They put me in an alternative school at first, so I had to do a quarter in the alternative school, which really wasn't a setting for me because I just wasn't in school. But I had to prove myself that, I had to prove to them that I can be in school. So they sent me to what was considered the alternative school there. I had to earn my way back in. I got flying grades in the alternative school because I only had to do half day. And for me, it was like, oh, I'm not bored. Just do this work and I get out of school early, fine. But when I went back to comprehensive campus, they did not adjust my schedule to fit that. They kind of were like, nope, you still need this, you still need that. I came in with all A's and A's. I got a letter being sent to me that actually asked me to go into some of the college courses on the campus. Yes.
I don't think I was ready for that plot twist. Are you saying because of your grades in the alternative school, when you transfer back into your traditional school, they say you need to be enrolled in college classes?
Yes, they asked. They was like, hey, your grades are all A's. Like, you have A's, mostly A's. You had to have a 90-something percent average. And my mom received a letter. But early on, educators constantly wanted to push my mother to send me to a special honor school. And my mother kind of was like, I don't want that pressure on her. So she wouldn't send me. And so by the time I got to high school, it kind of was like, this is boring. Like, you're not pushing back on me. And so if I can be here, if I cannot be here and show up and still pass, I don't need to be here. So the plot twist was that when I went back, they were like, they sent my mother a letter like for $50, she can take these courses at the college. My mom's like, I don't think you need that pressure because we need to get you through your senior year. We need to make sure you get through the senior year. So I went back and they told me I needed to do night school to take a few courses in night school in order to get the credits. Well, I went to night school and had this amazing economics teacher. He was a Black male. And he said to me, you know what? I know you. I know you're smarter than this. And if you can pass your junior ELA test, your senior ELA test, and what else was it? Your U.S. history exam. And I know you passed economics at the alternative school with straight A's. All you have to do is write a paper for me and pass those regent exams when they come up in January. I was like, are you serious? He's like, no, I'm really serious. Like, I don't think you need this type of, I think you need something different. And honestly, I read through my regents books and I went in and I passed all those tests. So I passed ELA 3, ELA 4. I wrote his paper, and I passed his economics. So it was passing his economics test. I did U.S. history and passed that with a 98. The only thing I kind of had a really struggle with was math, and I refused to take my chemistry one because I felt like I wasn't there enough to actually be able to pass that chemistry exam. But at the end of the day, I managed to graduate on time with my peers, and I went to college regardless of what my counselor said. I still ended up a college graduate no matter what her perspective on that was. I still did it, even though they were like, you're not going to graduate with those you came in with, and I still did.
Oh, Felicia. Dr. Rutledge. Doctor, okay? For anybody who's, and what I love so many things about your story. Definitely was not ready for the plot twist, because it goes to show sometimes we think our path will look one way, but it's getting on to this different path that puts us exactly where we're supposed to be. Also with like your mom trying to protect you, but in her attempt to protect you, it was keeping you away from like the the opportunities that you needed, like because you were so bored in that other program. But most of all, the fact that you were able to come back. You came back. What flipped that switch for you between your junior and senior year that make you say, like, you know what? Even if this is not as interesting as I feel like it should be, I'm still going to finish on time. Like, what made you commit back to finishing high school on time?
It took a community. It took family. It took friends of the family who all seen something in me. My mother tapped into previous educators. She tapped into everyone in the community who knew me, my cousins, my uncles, my aunts, and they just kept saying, we can't see you just going out like this. Like that, this is not, that's not your walk. Like, what do you want to do with your life? And so I had to start well, I want to do this. Well, you know, you can't do that if you don't finish high school. And because they all rallied around me and just poured into me during that time. And I mean, I was going through a lot. I mean, you're a teenager, so you just want your freedom. You just want to get away from it all and just, I don't want to do that. I want to do my own thing and I want to let I go my own way. And in them just pouring into me and saying, you're better than this. You can do more than this. There's people who need you out there. That's what urged me to go, okay, I'm gonna do this. I'm just gonna suck it up. I'm just going to get out of this space and go back. And I was like, oh, you told me I can't do this? Oh, I'm really gonna do this now. That telling me I couldn't or I was not able to, I never liked when someone told me I can't or that I wasn't good enough for something. So as soon as I heard the can'ts, I was like, oh, I'm doing this.
Yeah, I hope that every Black girl, every misunderstood Black girl who feels like they want to tap out and they feel alone, I hope that they pull and draw inspiration from your story. Because it's like getting back to this is not your walk. You are so much better than where you're putting yourself right now. Like, get back to you. So speaking about you and your walk and your journey, so now you've graduated with your peers, you back on top, you Felicia. How did you become Dr. Felicia? What led you to create, like, did you go to school with a declared major in education? What led you to build your career in education?
I did not go in with the idea that I was going to be an educator. I still had the mindset of, I just want to do something so I can get this done. And I went in actually declared under business. So I was declared under business and I said, I'm going to go into business and I'm going to do hair and I'm going to teach others how to do hair. Now, mind you, I said, teach others how to do hair and teach others how to build businesses within hair. And that was what my goal was. And something just told me to kind of look at what the options were, because mind you, my counselor told me, college is not for you. You're not going to go to college. So something told me to kind of really look through that catalog and see what interests me. And it still wasn't education. It was, I'm going to be a physical therapist assistant. I'm gonna do the 2 years, be a physical therapist assistant, and then when I'm done with the assistant degree, I'm gonna become a physical therapist. And so I went in and I was like, oh, I love these sciences. And I had a rough period where my grandmother passed. And that's where you seen like this real inequity and like no empathy when something is happening to you and you get no support on campus. And I do all of this and I really bombed kinesiology. I got a D. Everything else, B's, A's. I think I had one C that year. And they were like, you're going to have to wait a whole cycle to take kinesiology again or figure out if the university is going to provide that course. And I start looking at what a physical therapist degree was versus the physical therapist assistant, what the requirements were. And I said, well, if I'm going to do this, then I might as well went to get the physical therapist degree if I'm going to sit here instead of 2 years, 3 years, for 4 years, 5 years, just to go through the cycle again. And I loved science. Science was like a thing for me. I loved digging into everything science, just the application of how science applies to real world. but I also had a thing for English in that process. So I decided, you know what, I'm changing my major again. So I changed my major and I went into natural sciences. So I ended up graduating from our two-year degree program with natural sciences and transferring over to PWI, Canisius College. Shout out to my Canisius College people. I went into their clinical laboratory science degree program. And so I was like, oh, I'm going into science. This is going to be amazing. I get to actually apply some of the stuff I learned. Love the human body. I was that kid with my mom. She would have books on anatomy, and I would be knowing I shouldn't in her business and her textbooks at home. And it was going great. But then once again, you see the inequity in, like, I was an EOP student, an HEOP student. If anybody knows what that means, that's Equal Opportunity Program, where they provide you with tutoring services and counseling services. But you still go through things with, and people can identify with you because you're a Black student on a white campus, basically, when you're in a PWI. And I got to a point where I was just having a tough time with, of all things, organic chemistry. But I was tutoring high school students in organic chem, but I was struggling in the organic chem class they put me in. They put me in an organic chem class where you had to learn from each other and not from the instructor. He kind of was the facilitator, but you all taught each other. And it didn't mesh well with me. But I passed the lab. So I got called into the office and she said to me, you're not doing good in organic chem. Okay, is there anyone who can tutor me? We don't know if we can find you a tutor for it. Here's the list of numbers. You can reach out to these people. It wasn't even a true connection of, like, here's this person who can help you in organic chem. Because I had someone help me in calculus. Like, she took me all the way through calculus. But there wasn't a connection with anyone who could actually tutor me with organic chemistry. But I was passing the labs. And so there's something to be said when you can pass the actual application, but the book work, you're struggling because it's just not meshing well. You can't translate what's happening in this book into an exam, but you can translate it when you're in the lab. And finally, I was like, you know what? Maybe this is not for me. And I was like, well, I still have my love of English. I still have my love of language. I'm gonna dive right into English pre-law. I'm not even doing the rest. Like, I'm okay with science. I like science. I'll still tutor some of these students in chemistry and things like that. But yeah, I'll leave it. So I made another change and said, this is my major. I graduated a bachelor's in English and I was like, oh, I really just love the idea of learning. It was just grabbing me everywhere I went. And I walked through the campus and I just happened to be looking at graduate programs because they just happened near our student union have like a shelf of just brochures for each of the graduate programs. And I come across deaf education. And I'm looking at it, I'm like, oh, you teach language, you learn language. Science, I have to learn about the auditory system and how the ear works and how the brain develops language. This is so for me. And I applied and interviewed and got in and was completely enthralled in just deaf education. So I ended up with my master's in deaf ed. It was an amazing experience. Still at my same college, there were, I think, 8 of us that graduated, so it was a small cohort. So once again, back to that small setting, really intentional about what you're doing, and they completely immersed us in the School for the Deaf. So during that time, my sister hadn't told me, my nephew didn't go with her. I realized he's at the School for the Deaf, which pushed me even more because he hadn't seen many teachers look like him in deaf ed. And he's like, everyone, he's like, my aunt's here, signing to everyone. My aunt's here, this is my aunt's here. Oh my gosh, you didn't meet my aunt. Like, he was so excited just to see me there, to have someone who took an interest in his world, because that's a whole nother culture in itself. And so I graduated, and before I graduated, during my internship at the School for the Deaf, my student teaching time, I was doing the reading specialist. So I got to jump into every class and support them. And there was a retired teacher, and she said to me, "Hey, you know, jobs aren't easy in New York State, but Las Vegas is always looking for a teacher of the deaf." Oh, okay. On a whim, I just started applying. Got the position and came out here and was like, I want to do more. I don't just want to be a classroom teacher. I want to do more. And started looking into law school for advocacy, wanting to be a special education advocate, because now I'm in the realm of special education, but a really, really rare area that doesn't get a ton of attention. I really want to know how to advocate for these students. Like, what do I do? What do I do for these scholars that are often pushed aside and no accommodations for unless someone's speaking for them? And at the time, I had a 3-year-old daughter. So I was like, I don't know how this is going to work, trying to go to a brick and mortar. So I decided that I would make a few phone calls and find out what online schools offer doctorate programs in special education leadership, and came across Capella, and I was like, I like this idea. You go a few times out of your time to go meet and network with other people and learn the process. And I was like, I'm going to do this. I'm getting my doctorate.
This is just one of many stories, and we want to keep the conversation going.
Follow us on Instagram at blackeducators.matter.
Visit us online at www.blackeducatorsmatter.org.
Help build the movement by joining our Patreon.
Now, let's get back to our Project 500 podcast.
They interview you, they let me in, and I was like, okay, I'm gonna do this. And the craziest thing is, while I was doing that, I moved positions. I had taught deaf blind and moved to elementary deaf or hard of hearing for K-2. And it was totally different from what I had seen at the School for the Deaf. Everything is kind of homogeneous. You don't get a ton of students who are deaf with autism or deaf with other exceptionalities. But when I came into that setting, I ended up with students who were deaf with autism, deaf with Down syndrome, deaf with social emotional behaviors. And I was like, this is not my wheelhouse. Well, that turned into what my dissertation ended up being about. The experiences with those students drove me to figure out what strategies were teachers using who had students who were deaf with other exceptionalities, specifically students who were deaf with autism. What were the common strategies they were using? There are no best practices. I decided that that was going to be my driving focus, and I was able to complete my dissertation in specifically by talking with teachers and observing teachers about what were they doing in their classroom to increase student outcomes for that set of students within deaf education.
That is incredible. Incredible. And I don't think we've had an educator on the show yet that has worked in deaf education. So do you speak sign language?
Yes, I utilize sign language. Yes.
Utilize sign language.
Utilize it, speak it, ASL, sign exact English, pidgin. It just depends on how I'm meeting that student's needs, how I'm meeting those scholars' needs.
What about the Black dialect? What is it called?
Black American, like, so BSL, Black Sign Language. So it's funny because I follow a few Instagrammers, specifically Charmaine, and she's the one who's everybody's looking at on Netflix for Strong Black Lead. And So I'm like, well, what's different? I was like, oh, I know what's different. That everything that my peers who work in the field tell me is different about how I sign. It's the attitude. It's the way you throw a sign out there, because it's all your personality, in the words of Charmaine, putting some seasoning on your hands. So, yeah, it has been, but you have to really dig into ASL, and then it's your personality. It's how you just put it out there. And my friends who are in deaf ed tease me all the time. They're like, you're so animated. And I am. I'm really animated. I will jump on top of the table in a heartbeat to get a point across, sign everything. Like,
that is so cool. My mom is a retired speech pathologist now, consulting as a speech pathologist with schools. And she used to have a sign language book at home. So I know this, and you tell me if I'm right.
I can't see.
Oh, can you see me?
Go. So. Okay. Hi, I am Danielle.
Yay! Yes. I remember that from like when we were so little. I remember how to use the letters.
Yeah, so what you did was what we would consider more of a sign exact English. And it's just putting it in English-based terms.
Yeah.
So let me make sure you can see. So for me, it's my name, what? Felicia. And because I was in the community, shout outs to a deaf senior at the time when I was there. She was like, you have these big, huge hoops, because I was not relieving my identity just to be on a campus. I had these big, huge hoops, bamboo hoops in my ear with my name going across them, showing up. And she was like, and she was a black student, and she was like, you always wear these big, huge earrings. So your sign name is going to be... So it's just the F, and it drops from my ear. And I refuse to give up that sign name. People try to change it all the time. I'm like, nope. I'm keeping that. I got to keep that.
So how many different roles have you held in education? Currently, you're a project facilitator, but you have your master's in deaf education. So what different titles and roles have you had thus far on your journey?
I have been a teacher of deafblind in high school. So I taught students who were primarily deaf and blind, where I had to do tactile sign language. And then I was a teacher of the deaf for K-2 for 4 years. And then I said I want another change because, you know, just like my major, I did a ton of changes in education too, as far as grade levels go. My last 3 years in the classroom were in a preschool deaf or hard of hearing program. So ages 3 through 5. Were in the classroom with me. It was an amazing experience. Now I am what most people would consider an instructional coach. If no one's familiar with the word project facilitator. Mm. So it's really a K-12. So I support schools all the way from elementary to 12th grade with how they're setting up RTI, how they're setting up PBIS, and all of those components that go within those systems. So anywhere from looking at their data, pointing out disproportionality, providing cultural responsiveness, teaching strategies, and just pushing in on those questions that the outside person gives that perspective. So more of the consulting coaching aspect, popping in classrooms and things like that.
So as you reflect on all of your experiences with education, what would you say is the state of education in Black America, and how did we get here?
So when I look at education in Black America, I think we do a disservice to people who are Black, Indigenous, people of color, specifically because we center it on one particular group of people from their perspective, from their history, and we make it a monolithic educational system. For everybody, for everyone else to be indoctrinated that there's one superior culture. And so I think we do a really big disservice because that's how the system has been ingrained and set up. We do a disservice to all the other cultures and perspectives that come into play and the backgrounds and how much seasoning and texture that could actually provide for a student's education.
Mm-hmm. And how do you think we got here?
I think we got here because the system was set up and they were forced to accept us. It wasn't that they opened their arms and said, come on in, we need you. It was, oh, so these policies were put in place and now we have to accept you, so we're gonna change the target. And we know how we tell teachers all the time, like, hey, you have to stick with your target, you can't change the target, the students. But when we decided that we were going to desegregate and place Black, Indigenous, and people of color within that system, the target then changed and things became, well, you need to be indoctrinated into our system. You need to be productive citizens in society. And the best way to do it is to hold you to a standard that is centered on white supremacy.
Your background, you have a very diverse background, but that special education component and that special education lens, looking at schools through that lens, would you say that schools are designed for students of color?
No. I'm just going to flat out say it. We put the same barriers within a school, because school is specifically an institution that indoctrinates what society looks like. In a school, looking from the lens of a special educator, students are placed in specific groupings from their deficits versus trying to leverage their brilliance in the moment. We put them in separate classrooms, which we put them in at separate tables at the lunchroom. We segregate students within a school in which you say we're integrated. They're still separate. They're still separate and they're not even equal, even though we always like separate and equal. They're separate, they're not equal. There was a conversation that I had with a principal that, well, why do I need to worry about that 3-7% of my population? Well, if you're for all, you should be worried about that perspective. And going back on the words of Dr. Marion Smith, when he was like, it's the Purple Heart perspective or the pilot perspective. The Purple Heart is everybody who participates is good, but that pilot perspective is we're gonna make sure everybody get there safely. And right now we operate with the Purple Heart perspective. Okay, you participate, you good. I gotta worry about this majority group of people who participated. I can't worry about that 3-7%. But you're doing a very disservice to equity in general when you don't include them, when you don't hold them to a standard that of exceptionality, when you don't have that rigor for them just as you have for that other 90-something percent of students in the classroom.
When you say all students, you have to mean all students.
All students.
Even if it is a 3%, all students. Mm-hmm. How have you grown since you began your career?
I have to say I've grown tremendously in amplifying my voice and amplifying the voice of the scholars that come into contact with me. I have to say, initially, I feel like I was set up to fail. I didn't have that support that I felt I needed. I went to get my doctorate because no one could provide me with the professional development I needed to support the students I had. It was kind of like, ooh, you should try this. Just do this and see if that works. Whereas I pushed myself to do more to support those scholars. But I definitely have grown in the way of, like, I'm very transparent with my students, my scholars. I'm very transparent with educators. Like, I will educate an educator in a heartbeat. I've had educators that call me all the time and say, or text me and say, hey, I have this going on in my classroom. I know this is your area. What can I say to advocate in this situation? I have parents who have come to me and I have to say, like, hey, I'm going to take off my organizational hat and I'm going to provide you with this information so you can advocate for your child. I've had to teach my, as early as my 3-5-year-old scholars when I was in preschool, how to ensure that reaffirm that their feelings are what their feelings are, but also to create very clear boundaries of what they aren't going to accept and what they need. So if I was pushing a kid into general education, I want you to be very clear on, I need to sit here. I need to be able to see the interpreter. I need this for me. Like, just embedding those advocacy skills in all, at all levels. So I've become very vocal and transparent about how to advocate.
What challenges have you grown through?
So there was a point where I was on a school campus and I just felt unsupported, like extremely unsupported. Everything I did was wrong in this administrator's eyes. And I had to learn that it wasn't really a reflection of me. It was a reflection of them and what their insecurities were within the situation. So even within my current situation, I had to realize that the things that were being said about me or being done to me weren't really a reflection of me as a person or of my excellence or of my brilliance. It was a reflection of their insecurity and their ego-driven selfishness in that moment. And I had to learn how to, one, be abreast of the research, two, be able to take that research and say, hey, this is how I'm going to advocate for myself in this moment, and just move on. Learning when to say, no, it's time for me to go.
That's real. I'm going to receive that as well. What advice do you have for first-year educators?
Find a community. Find a community of like-minded individuals, educators, those who you can talk to so you know you're being gaslit. Because there are times where you really think you are crazy. Like, people will make you feel like you are crazy, like you are unworthy, like you are not enough. And I'm one to tell you, you are enough. You just need those educators rallying around you, that close-knit circle rallying around you, saying, hey, pouring into you and saying, hey, no, let me tell you what you could do in this situation. Let me tell you how I can support you in this situation. Let me tell you who else can support you in this situation. Let me provide you with this information. Just find a really close-knit community of educators who look like you, who are going through, most of us are going through the same exact thing you're going through at the time when you're going through it, and don't be afraid to speak up.
You have found ways to encourage yourself and find light in darkness throughout your entire experience with education, even as a student, now as an educator. So thank you for sharing that, and thank you for walking us through. You've named several Black educators who have been influential to you. Are there any others outside of the ones I can think of off the top of your head? Your phys ed teacher early on, I appreciate him, but I also really appreciate that Black economics teacher when you talked about, you know, how he came in and he showed you the how. He kind of showed you the way out, where it's like, I know that I cannot stay here. The way that I think I can move forward is like, but he was like, listen, if you do 1, 2, and 3, if you pass this, this, and this, you will go here. And like, it worked. It worked.
It worked. And I have to give like shout out to Miss Kopic, because she was my sixth grade teacher who was like, I'm gonna tap into your brilliance. You like science, you like language. Let me get you out here. Let me let you speak. Let me let you see what this is like from the lens of being a speaker. So early on, spoken word, storytelling, that was like one of the things she pushed me towards. Shout out to Miss Washington, who was a counselor, social worker at the time, who stepped in and said, I want you on this leadership team for Project Respect. And when I messed up and got into a fight, she was like, we got to bring it to your peers. But I'm rooting for you to remain a leader in this situation, because leaders do make mistakes. Like, that is, mistakes are not above anyone, but we got you. The fact that I had a Black principal, Ms. Donette Ruffin, at the time when I was in K-8, she was absolutely amazing. One of those women where you just like, oh, you're my principal. When I got in trouble, she was like, and we're going to keep you here, because we're going to keep you here, but I need you to, you know, follow through with some things. Shout out to Ms. Steins, who was the math teacher, because I was always like, I hate math. Math is not my thing. But she was the math. She was my 8th and 7th grade math teacher, and she was about that business. And she brought in real-life perspective to all of it for us. And she actually lived around the corner. Like, she was in the community. Her son went to the school with us. So shouts out to her. She was absolutely a dynamic math teacher. And I can remember plenty of lessons where she brought the real of Blackness into the classroom. It's like, this is the reality for you guys. This is what needs to happen right now. Just being really honest and transparent and authentic. So shouts out to all the Black educators that remained authentic in my journey throughout my process of education.
Now, do you have a website or anything where people who want to follow you and learn more about what you're doing can connect with you?
I am on Instagram, so people can follow me at Miss So Educated, MZSOEDUCATED. I am also on Twitter as at Educated So, so EDUCATEDSO. And those are the places you can find me right now. I will be coming through with a website soon. I'm just trying to get it all together. And I will be doing some more of the professional learning sessions that are really personalized to meet your needs. Because we know, as educators, we go and, like, we want to grow. And that's where a lot of teacher retention falls, because we aren't growing and we feel stagnant. So the idea is to create a space where you get some personalized professional learning, tapping into your brilliance and liberating your learning through that lens, as well as supporting teachers in advocacy work. I love doing that aspect of things too, and students as well. I love liberating students to dive into their passions. So I have some things coming out very, very soon, a scope and sequence for liberating learners into entrepreneurial skills as well.
Because we did not forget about that business background. We did not forget. You got all these other backgrounds. We did not forget about that. Thank you so much, Dr. Rutledge. Everything that you have done, it was, it is, and it always will be worth it. So thank you.
I appreciate you, Danielle, for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Black Educators Matter.
Are you ready to share your story? Visit us online at www.blackeducatorsmatter.org to sign up.
Remember, make excellence equitable and thank a Black teacher today.